You're listening to...
Everybody, we had a little technical difficulties trying to get the music going, but welcome back to the Bareback Backs, guys. As always, I am your host, Dallas Duclo, and with today's topic, we are going to continue on with cold history, and today we're talking about the very controversial David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. We're going to get into the Waco incident, the Waco Siege today. We're going to be talking about that as well, but before we do, guys, I'd like to remind you, and we do have a call-in number at 718-508-9883. And if you guys decide to call in, you'd like to have a nice little discussion with me, that is always welcome. Just keep it clean and keep it about the subject matter. As always, further ado, guys, let's get started right now. So first off, we're going to start with who David Koresh is. So who was David Koresh? Now, David was born on August 17th in 1959 in Houston, Texas. And he grew up in a family that was quite dysfunctional. He didn't have a very conventional early childhood. He was born under the name Vernon Wayne Howell, and he was born to a 14-year-old single mother named Bonnie Sue Clark and a father by the name of Bobby Wayne Howell. Before Koresh was born, his father met another teenage girl and abandoned Bonnie Sue. Koresh himself would never meet his father, and his mother began cohabiting with a violent alcoholic. In 1963, Koresh's mother left her boyfriend and placed her 4-year-old son in the care of his maternal grandmother, Earlene Clark. His mother returned when he was 7 after her marriage to a carpenter named Roy Haldeman. Haldeman and Clark had a son together named Roger, who would be born 3 years later in 1966. Koresh described his early childhood as lonely. Due to his poor study skills and dyslexia, he was put in a special education system of classes and nicknamed Vernie by his fellow students. Koresh would drop out of Garland High School in his junior year due to his frustrations with school. When Koresh was 22 years old, he began a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old girl who would later become pregnant. He claimed to have become a born-again Christian in the Southern Baptist Church and soon joined his mother's church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. There, he became infatuated with the pastor's daughter, and while praying for guidance, he opened his eyes and allegedly found the Bible open at Isaiah 34, chapter 34, verse 16, stating that none should want her for a mate, and convinced this was a sign from God, he approached the pastor and told him that God wanted him to have his daughter for a wife. Honestly, the pastor reacted in about the same way just about any father would probably react to this wild statement. He threw him out, and when Koresh continued to persist with his pursuit of the daughter, he would later be expelled from the congregation. In 1982, he would move to Waco, Texas, where he would join the Branch Davidians, not to be confused with the original Davidian Seventh-day Adventist group. There, a man named Ben Roden originated the branch group. Roden had studied under Victor Hutef, but upon the death of Hutef in 1955, he formed his own group with new teachings that were not connected with the original Davidians. Up to this point, Koresh played guitar and sang in church services at Mount Carmel Center, and his band played a few times at clubs in Waco, and former members such as David Thibodeau have written that he recruited them through music. Koresh also tried to pursue his own record company, but he was not successful due to lack of funds and support. But before we continue on to talk about David Koresh's rise to cult leader, we need to look a little bit more at David Koresh in his relationship with other individuals in this group. Now, early on, David Koresh had started to gain support from people already in this group, the Branch Davidians. So who are the Branch Davidians? The Branch Davidians, also known as the Branch, were a religious group that originated in 1955 from a schism among the Shepherds, Rods, and Davidians. The Branch group was initially led by a man by the name of Benjamin Roden. Branch Davidians are most associated with, of course, now David Koresh and the siege of 1993 in Waco. The doctrinal beliefs of the Branch Davidians differ on teachings such as the Holy Spirit and his nature and the feast days and their requirements. Both groups have disputed the relevance of the other's spiritual authority based on the proceedings following Victor Hudef's death. Now, from its inception in 1930, the Davidians and Shepherd's Rod group, respectively, believed themselves to be living in a time when the biblical prophecies of a final divine judgment were coming to pass as a prelude to Christ's second coming. In the late 1980s, Koresh and his followers abandoned many Branch Davidian teachings. Koresh himself became the group's self-proclaimed final prophet, and Koreshians were the majority resulting from the schism among the Branch Davidians. But some of the Branch Davidians did not join Koresh's group and instead gathered around George Roden or became independent themselves. Now, following a series of violent shootouts between Roden's and Koresh's group, the Mount Carmel compound was eventually taken over by the Koreshians. This would later prompt this tremendously controversial siege that we're going to be talking about that would occur in 1993 between Koresh and his followers and the ATF and Texas Army National Guard. Now we have a general idea of who these guys are to a degree, but to get a little deeper into who the Branch Davidians are, because I do think it's important that we do get a good grasp of where they come from. Their founder, Victor Hudef, a Bulgarian immigrant and Seventh-day Adventist Sabbath school teacher in a local church in Southern California, claimed in 1929 that he had a new message for the entire church. He presented his views in a book, The Shepherd's Rod, The 144,000, A Call for Reformation. The Adventist leadership rejected his views as contrary to the Adventist basic teachings and local church congregations disfellowshipped Hudef and his followers as a consequence. In 1935, Victor would establish his headquarters to the west of Waco, Texas, and his group became known as the Shepherd's Rod. In 1942, he renamed the group to the General Association of Davidian Seventh-day Adventists, Davidian indicating the belief in the restoration of the Davidic Kingdom of Israel. And if you're not familiar with the Davidic Kingdom of Israel, David was, you know, considered to be the true king of Israel for quite some time following Saul. And so, not to get too far into the Bible, for those of you who are not familiar with it, you'll just have to go pick one up, pretty easy to get. But David was the favorite king of chosen people of Israel. He was the favorite king of God. And, you know, despite his many failings as a man, he was about as close to divine as you could get, as close to the divine ruler as you can get in the Bible. And as you could get on earth without him being Jesus himself. And there's even some dispute amongst religious scholars as to whether or not, you know, David is supposed to be this precursor to Christ or if that he is of the same bloodline of Jesus Christ, you know, or vice versa. So that being said, that should give you an idea of why the Davidic kingdom is important to people within this group. Following the death of Victor Hudef in 1955, the segment of the group loyal to him continued as the Davidian Seventh-day Adventists, led by his wife Florence. Convinced of an imminent apocalypse and purported by Florence's time setting, which was not found in the original writings of her husband Victor, Florence Hutef and her council gathered hundreds of faithful followers together at their Mount Carmel Center near Waco in 1959 for the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecies. Following this disappointment, Benjamin Roden formed another group called the Branch Davidians and succeeded in taking control of Mount Carmel. This name is an allusion to the anointed branch mentioned in Zechariah 3:8 and chapter 6, verse 12 as well. When Benjamin Roden died in 1978, he would later be succeeded by his wife Lois Roden, and members of the Branch Davidians would later be torn for allegiance between Lois Roden and his son George. After Lois Roden died, the authority was passed to George Roden, but less than a year later, Vernon Howell, a.k.a. David Koresh, rose to power and became leader over the group. So now that we have the background of this organization out of the way, let us take a look at David Koresh's rise, the organization. Now, in 1983, Koresh began claiming the gift of prophecy. Now, it's speculated by David Thibodeau in his 1999 book, A Place Called Waco, that he had a sexual relationship with Lois Roden. And some people, this is debated by many people, but there are many, many people who have claimed that Koresh seduced Lois Roden in order to gain the influence that he gained over this organization. Now, the prophet, and Lois at the time was the prophetess and leader of the sect, who was at that time 65 years old, eventually claiming that God had chosen him to father a child with her who would be the chosen one. Now, in 1983, Lois Roden allowed Koresh to begin teaching his own message called the Serpent's Root in the group. Lois Roden's son, George Roden, intended to be the group's next leader and considered Koresh to be an interloper. And when Koresh announced that God had instructed him to marry Rachel Jones, who then added Koresh to her name, there was a short period of calm at Mount Carmel Center, but it proved only temporary. Keep in mind, Rachel Jones was only 15 at the time. In the ensuing power struggle, George Roden, claiming to have the support of the majority of the group, forced Koresh and his group off the property at gunpoint. Now, in 1985, Koresh and around 25 of his followers would set up a camp at Palestine, Texas, 90 miles from Waco, where they lived under rough conditions in buses and tents for the next 2 years, during which time Koresh undertook recruitment of new followers in California, the United Kingdom, Israel, and Australia. Let's just say Koresh got around, okay? That same year, Koresh traveled to Israel, where he claimed that he had a vision that he was the modern-day Cyrus. And if you're not familiar with who Cyrus is, Cyrus was a Persian king. Now, the founder of the Davidian movement, Victor Hutef, wanted to be God's implement and establish the Davidic kingdom in Palestine. Koresh also wanted to be God's tool and set up the Davidic kingdom in Jerusalem. At least until 1990, he believed the place of his martyrdom might be in Israel, but by 1991, he was convinced that his martyrdom would be in the United States. Instead of Israel, he said the prophecies of Daniel would be fulfilled in Waco, and that the Mount Carmel Center was the Davidic kingdom that he must claim. After being exiled to the Palestine camp, Koresh and his followers eked out a primitive existence. When Lois Roden died in 1986, the exiled Branch Davidians wondered if they would ever be able to return home to Mount Carmel Center, the promised land. But despite the displacement, Koresh now enjoyed the loyalty of the majority of the Branch Davidian community. By late 1987, George Roden's support was in steep decline. To regain it, he challenged Koresh to a contest to raise the dead, going so far as to exhume a corpse to demonstrate his spiritual supremacy. Koresh went to authorities to file charges against Roden for illegally exhuming a corpse, but was told he would have to show proof, such as a photograph of the corpse. Now, before we continue on to talk about this spiritual challenge of David Koresh, we're going to take a short commercial break, guys. And it's at this time I remind you that we do have a proud sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChristopherAleyPresents.com. And when we return, we're going to talk about this spiritual battle between David Koresh and George Roden and the outcome. We're going to get to the end of the line with David Koresh and the Branch Davidians.
I'm black man, saving man's eye, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, everybody. Before we left, we talked about the spiritual battle of Koresh and George Roden. Now, Koresh attempted to find pictures of this corpse that was going to be exhumed because Roden challenged him to a feat of spiritual combat. That's right. Both of them are going to raise a body from the dead. Koresh, though, decided to go a different route, being seen as how, despite the fact that he claimed to be a legitimate prophet from God himself, he felt no need to try and raise the dead, mainly because it was freaking impossible. So he instead used his brain and seized the opportunity to seek criminal prosecution of Roden by returning to Mount Carmel Center with 7 armed followers attempting to get photographic proof of the crime. Koresh's group, however, would be discovered by Roden, and a gunfight would break out. When the sheriff arrived, Roden had already suffered a minor gunshot wound and was pinned down behind a tree. As a result of the incident, Koresh and his followers were charged with attempted murder. At the trial, Koresh explained that he went to Mount Carmel Center to uncover evidence of a criminal disturbance of a corpse by Roden. Koresh's followers would be acquitted, amazingly enough, and in Koresh's case, a mistrial was declared. Now, in 1989, Roden murdered Wayman Dale Adair with an axe blow to the skull after Adair stated his belief that he, Adair, was the true Messiah. Roden would be convicted of murder and imprisoned in a psychiatric hospital at Big Spring, Texas. Since Roden owed thousands of dollars in unpaid taxes on Mount Carmel Center, Koresh and his were able to raise the money and reclaim the property. Roden continued to harass the Koresh faction by filing legal papers while in prison. When Koresh and his followers reclaimed Mount Carmel Center, they discovered that tenants who had rented from Roden had left behind a methamphetamine laboratory, which Koresh reported to the local police department and asked to have removed. Now, at this point, Koresh has not legally changed his name. He still got the legal name of Vernon Howell. His followers are calling him Koresh, but now he's going to make it official. Now, on May 15th, 1990, he files a petition in California State Superior Court in Pomona to legally change his name for publicity and business purposes to David Koresh. And on August 28th of the same year, Judge Robert Martinez grants the petition. Koresh's name of Cyrus the Great, Koresh, a Persian king who was named a messiah for freeing Jews during the Babylonian captivity. His first name, David, symbolized the lineage directly to the biblical King David from whom the new messiah would descend. By taking the name of David Koresh, he was professing himself to be the spiritual descendant of King David and a messianic figure carrying out a divinely commissioned errand. Now, Koresh was allegedly involved over his time as head of the Branch Davidians in multiple incidents of child abuse and sexual abuse. Now, whilst those claims were never proven, Koresh's doctrine of the House of David did lead to marriages with both married and single women in the group, purportedly with at least one girl who was underage, that being Rachel Jones, otherwise known as Michelle Jones. The underage girl, Michelle Jones, the younger sister of Koresh's legal wife, Rachel, and the daughter of lifelong Branch Davidians, Perry and Mary Bell Jones. Koresh allegedly had sex with her when she was only 13, evidently with the consent of the Joneses. Still a little bit skeezy there, but, you know, hey, I guess, you know, when you're a cult leader, you can get away with those kinds of things. Not really, as we're going to see. This still doesn't pan out very well for Koresh and his followers. A 6-month investigation would ensue after this got out. These investigations were centered around child abuse allegations by the Texas Child Protection Services in 1992. However, these failed to turn up any evidence, possibly because the Branch Davidians concealed the spiritual marriage of Koresh to Michelle Jones, assigning a surrogate husband, David Thibodeau, to the girl for the sake of appearances. Now, regarding the allegations of child abuse, the evidence is less sure. In one widely reported incident, ex-members claim that Koresh became irritated with the cries of his son Cyrus and spanked the child severely for several minutes on 3 consecutive visits to the child's bedroom. In a second report, a man involved in a custody battle visited Mount Carmel Center and claimed to have seen the beating of a young boy with a stick. Finally, the FBI's justification for forcing an end to what would become a 51-day standoff was predicated on the charge that Koresh was abusing children inside Mount Carmel Center. In hours following what would become a deadly conflagration, one Attorney General Janet Reno told reporters that we had specific information that babies were being beaten. However, later FBI Director William Sessions publicly denied the charge and told reporters that they had no such information about child abuse inside Mount Carmel Center. A careful examination of the other child abuse charges found the evidence to be weak and ambiguous, casting doubt on the allegations. So, in this instance, we're not entirely sure exactly what all's going on inside Mount Carmel during this time. What we do know is that by 1990, David Koresh has complete control over the Branch Davidians and Mount Carmel. Now, the allegations of child abuse stem largely from detractors and ex-members of this group. And the 1993 U.S. Department of Justice report cites allegations of child sexual and physical abuse. Legal scholars point out that the ATF had no legal jurisdiction in the matter of child protection, and it appears that these accounts were inserted by the ATF to inflame the case against Koresh that they were trying to build. For example, the account of former Branch Davidian Jeanine Buns is reproduced in the affidavit. She claimed that Koresh had fathered at least 15 children with various women and that she had personally delivered 7 of these children. Buns also claims that Koresh would annul all marriages of couples who joined the group and had exclusive sexual access to the woman of the group. Koresh fathered multiple children by different women in the group. His House of David doctrine was based on a purported revelation that involved the procreation of 24 children by chosen women in the community. These 24 children were to serve as the ruling elders over the millennium after the return of Christ. In his book, James Tabor states that Koresh acknowledged on a videotape sent out of the compound during the standoff that he had fathered more than 12 children by several wives. On March 3, 1993, during negotiations to secure the release of the remaining children, Koresh advised the negotiation team of this: "My children are different than those others," referring to his direct lineage versus those children who had previously been released. So here's some of the controversy involving Koresh, that perhaps he was engaged in some sordid relationships with young girls and children. But again, this is something that to this day, people are still not entirely sure how much of it's accurate that David Koresh was doing this. What we do know is that David Koresh wielded a tremendous amount of influence. Now, as leader of the Branch Davidians, Koresh claimed that he had cracked the code of the 7 seals in the Book of Revelation, which predicted the events leading to the apocalypse and the final confrontation between the forces of God and the forces of the devil. He told his followers that the Lord willed the Davidians to build an army of God, and as a consequence, they started stockpiling weapons. Now, this stockpiling is what draws the suspicion of the ATF in the first place. Not only was it the early gun battles between David Koresh and his followers with George Roden and his followers that starts to draw the ire of the federal organization that is the ATF, but it's this suspicious behavior of stockpiling a large number of weapons in this compound that is closed off from much of the rest of the community around it. That is what draws the suspicion of the ATF, leading to the Waco siege, the standoff in Waco. The Waco siege, as it's known, was the siege of a compound belonging to the Branch Davidians carried out by the American federal and Texas state law enforcement, as well as the U.S. military, between February 28th and 8th of 1993. The Branch Davidians were led by David Koresh and were headquartered at Mount Carmel Center Ranch in the community of Axtell, Texas, 13 miles east-northeast of Waco. Suspecting the group of stockpiling illegal weapons, the ATF obtained a search warrant for the compound and arrest warrants for Koresh and a select few of the group's members. The incident would begin when the ATF attempted to raid the ranch. Upon their arrival, an intense gun battle erupted, resulting in the deaths of 4 government agents and 6 Branch Davidians. Upon the ATF's failure to raid the compound, a siege lasting 51 days was initiated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, eventually, the FBI launched an assault and initiated a tear gas attack in an attempt to force the Branch Davidians out of the ranch. However, during the attack, a fire engulfed Mount Carmel Center, and in total, 76 people would die, including David Koresh himself. Now, there's a great deal of dispute that remains as to the actual events of the siege. A particular controversy ensued over the origin of the fire. An internal Justice Department investigation concluded in 2000 that sect members had started the fire. The events near Waco and the siege at Ruby Ridge less than 12 months earlier were both cited as the primary motivations behind the Oklahoma City bombing that took place exactly 2 years later. Moves us to the development of the compound. And we're going to talk, we're going to get into the meat of the details of the Waco siege. We've kind of danced around it and given you a little bit of a taste of what exactly happened that we know of. Now we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about what was going on in Mount Carmel that we know of and what government officials decided to do in response to what they thought was going on. Now, as I mentioned before, they decided to take over Mount Carmel Center, and they named it this building Mount Carmel after a mountain in Israel mentioned in the book of Joshua in the Bible's Old Testament. A few years later, they would move away and then return, obviously, with David Koresh at their head. Now, following their return and the death of, or the eventual removal of George Roden, which ends with him ending up in a mental ward for quite some time, we see the release of a very interesting and controversial film by David Koresh himself. Now, on August 5th, 1989, David Koresh released the New Light audio tape, in which he stated that he had been told by God to procreate with the women in the group to establish a house of David, of his special people. This involved separating married couples in the group and agreeing that only he could have sexual relations with the wives, whilst the men should observe celibacy. He also claimed that God had told him to start building an army for God to prepare for the end of days and a salvation for his followers. It was shortly after this that Howell would file to have his name changed to David Koresh. Now, by 1992, most of the land belonging to the group had been sold except for a core 77 acres. Most of the buildings had been removed or were being salvaged for construction materials to convert much of the main chapel and a tall water tank into apartments for the resident members of the group. Many of the members of the group had been involved with the Davidians for a few generations, and many had large families. Now, on February 27th in 1993, the Waco Tribune Herald began publishing The Sinful Messiah, a series of articles by Mark England and Darlene McCormick, who reported allegations that Koresh had physically abused children in the compound and had committed statutory rape by taking multiple underage brides. Koresh was also said to advocate polygamy for himself and declared himself married to several female residents of the small community. According to the paper, Koresh declared he was entitled to at least 140 wives and that he was entitled to claim any of the females in the group as his own, that he had fathered at least a dozen children, and that some of these mothers became brides as young as 12 or 13 years old. Now, this is purely speculation on their part for the most part here. In addition to allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct, Koresh and his followers were suspected of stockpiling illegal weapons. In May of 1992 specifically, Chief Deputy Daniel Weyenberg of the McLennan County Sheriff's Department called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to notify them that his office had been contacted by a local UPS representative. A UPS driver described a package that had been broken open on delivery to the Branch Davidian residents, revealing firearms, inert grenade casings, and black powder. Now, on June 9th, a formal investigation happened, and a week later, it was classified as sensitive, thereby calling for a high degree of oversight from both Houston and headquarters. The documentary Inside Waco claims that the investigation started when in 1992 the ATF became concerned over reports of automatic gunfire coming from the Carmel compound. On July 30th, ATF agents David Aguilera and Skinner visited the Branch Davidians gun dealer Henry McMahon, who tried to get them to talk with Koresh on the phone. Koresh offered to let ATF inspect the Branch Davidians weapons and paperwork and asked to speak with Aguilera, but Aguilera declined. Sheriff Harwell told reporters regarding law enforcement talking with Koresh, just go and talk to them. What's wrong with notifying them? At this point, the ATF began surveillance from a house across the road from the compound several months before the siege. Their cover was noticeably poor. The college students were in their 30s and had new cars and were not registered at the local schools and did not keep a schedule, which would not have fit any legitimate employment or classes. So they disguised themselves as college students and did a very poor job of it. The investigation included sending in an undercover agent, Robert Rodriguez, whose identity Koresh learned, though he chose not to reveal that fact until the day of the raid. The ATF would obtain a search warrant on suspicion that the Davidians were modifying guns to have illegal automatic fire capability. Former Branch Davidian Mark Brault claimed that Koresh had M16 lower receiver parts, combining M16 trigger components with a modified AR-15 lower receiver is, according to ATF regulations, constructive possession of an unregistered machine gun regulated in the Firearm Owners Protection Act of 1986. So, using the affidavit that would later be filed, Aguilera, that allegedly the Davidians had violated federal law, the ATF obtained search and arrest warrants for Koresh and specific followers on weapons charges, citing the many firearms that they had accumulated. And the search warrant commanded a search on or before February 28th of 1993 in the daytime between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. ATF made a claim that Koresh was possibly operating a methamphetamine lab, despite the fact that he had asked them to remove one, and that he was attempting to establish a drug nexus and obtain military assets under the war on drugs. Although the ATF's investigation focused on firearm violations, not on illegal drugs, the ATF requested assistance from the DEA and the DOD, citing a drug connection based on, one, a recent delivery to the compound of chemicals, instruments, and glassware, two, a written testimony from a former compound's resident alleging Howell had told him that drug trafficking was a desirable way to raise money, three, several current residents who had prior drug involvement, and four, two former residents who were incarcerated for drug trafficking crimes, and finally, five, National Guard overflights. Thermal images showed a hot spot inside the compound, possibly indicating a methamphetamine laboratory. Although the original request for it was initially approved, the commander of the Special Forces Detachment questioned the request, and the ATF obtained only a training site at Fort Hood, Texas, from February 25th to February 27th, with safety inspections for the training lanes, and was given only medical and communications training and equipment. The ATF had planned their raid for Monday, March 1st, 1993, with the code name Showtime. The ATF later claimed that the raid was moved up a day to February 28th, 1993, in response to the Waco Tribune Herald's The Sinful Messiah series of articles, which the ATF had tried to prevent from being published. Beginning February 1st, ATF agents had three meetings with the Tribune Herald staff regarding the delay in publication of The Sinful Messiah. The paper was first told by ATF that the raid would take place on February 22nd, which they changed to March 1st, and then ultimately to an indefinite date. ATF agents felt the newspaper had held off publication at the request of the ATF for at least 3 weeks. In a February 24th meeting between the Herald staff and ATF agent Cho Janke and two other ATF agents, could not give the newspaper staff a clear idea of what action was planned or when. And Herald informed ATF that they were publishing the series, which included an editorial calling for local authorities to act. Personnel of the Tribune Herald found out about the imminent raid after the first installment of Sin for Messiah and had already appeared on February 27th. Now, although the ATF preferred to arrest Koresh when he was outside Mount Carmel, planners received inaccurate information that Koresh rarely left it. The Branch Davidian members were well known locally and had cordial relations with other locals. The Davidians partly supported themselves by trading at gun shows and took care to have the relevant paperwork to ensure their transactions were completely legal. How could they do such a thing? Participate in legal trades. What were they thinking? Branch Davidian Paul Fada was a federal firearms licensed dealer, and the group operated a retail gun business called the Mag Bag. When shipments for the Mag Bag arrived, they were signed by Fada, Steve Schneider, or Koresh. The morning of the raid, Fada and son Kalani were on their way to to Austin, Texas gun show to conduct business. On Sunday morning, February 28, 1993, and any advantage of surprise was lost when a KWTX-TV reporter who had been tipped off about the raid, and the ATF's just not very good at keeping things a secret, asked for directions from a U.S. Postal Service mail carrier who was coincidentally Koresh's brother-in-law. Excuse me. Koresh then told undercover ATF agent Robert Rodriguez that they knew that a raid was imminent. Rodriguez had infiltrated the Branch Davidians and was astonished to find out that his cover had been blown. So not only was the ATF poor at keeping their operation a secret, they were also piss poor at putting in undercover agents. The agent made an excuse and left the compound. When asked later what the Branch Davidians had been doing when he left the compound, Rodriguez replied that they were praying. Branch Davidian survivors have written that Koresh ordered selected male followers to begin arming and taking up defensive positions, whilst the women and children were told to take cover in their rooms. Koresh told them he would try to speak to the agents, and what happened next would depend on the agents' intentions. Despite being informed that the Branch Davidians knew a raid was coming, the ATF commander ordered that the raid go ahead, even though their plan depended on reaching the compound without Branch Davidians being armed and prepared. While not standard procedure, ATF agents had their blood type written on their arms or neck after leaving the staging area and before the raid because it was recommended by the military to facilitate speedy blood transfusions in case of injury. ATF agents stated later that they heard gunshots coming from within the compound, while Branch Davidian survivors claimed that the first shots came from the ATF agents outside. A suggested reason may have been an accidental discharge of a weapon, possibly by an ATF agent, causing the ATF to respond with fire from automatic weapons. Other reports claim that the first shots were fired by the ATF dogs in the Branch Davidian kennel. Three Army National Guard helicopters were used as aerial distraction, and all took incoming fire but did not return it. During the first shots, Koresh was wounded, having been shot in the wrist. Within a minute of the raid starting, Branch Davidian Wayne Martin called emergency services, pleading for them to stop shooting. The resident asked for a ceasefire, and audio tapes record him saying, "Here they come again, and that's them shooting. That's not us." The first ATF casualty was an agent who made it to the west side of the building before he was wounded. Agents quickly took cover and fired at the buildings while the helicopters began their diversion and swept in low over the complex, 350 feet away from the building. The Branch Davidians fired on the helicopters and hit them without injuring the crew, and the helicopters immediately stopped the mission and landed. Now, on the east side of the compound, agents hauled out two ladders and set them against the side of the building. Agents then climbed onto the roof with the objective of securing the roof to reach Koresh's room and the arms storage. On the west slope of the roof, three agents reached Koresh's window and were crouching beside it when they, too, came under fire. One agent was killed in this moment and another wounded. The third agent managed to scamper over the peak of the roof and join other agents attempting to enter the arms room. The wet window would later be smashed and a flashbang stun grenade thrown in it. And the three agents entered the room right after this. Now, when another tried to follow them, a hail of bullets penetrated the wall and wounded him, but he was able to reach a ladder and slide to safety. An agent fired with a shotgun at Branch Davidians, who were shooting at him until he was hit in the head and killed. Inside the arms room, the agents killed a Branch Davidian gunman and discovered a cache of weapons, but then came under heavy fire. In this moment, two more ATF agents are wounded. As they escaped, the third agent laid down covering fire, killing a Branch Davidian. And as he made his escape, he hit his head on a wooden support beam and fell off the roof, but survived. An agent outside provided them with covering fire, but he too would be shot by a Branch Davidian and instantly killed. Dozens of ATF agents took cover, many behind Branch Davidian vehicles, and exchanged fire with the Branch Davidians. The number of ATF wounded increased, and an agent was killed by the gunfire from the compound as agents were firing at a Branch Davidian perched on the water tower. The exchange of fire continued, but 45 minutes into the raid, the gunfire began to slow down as the agents began to run low on ammunition. The shooting continued for 2 hours. Sheriff Lieutenant Lynch of the McLennan County Sheriff's Department contacted the ATF and negotiated a ceasefire. Harwell states in William Gazecki's documentary Waco, The Rules of Engagement, that the ATF agents withdrew only after they were out of ammunition. ATF agent Chuck Hussmeyer wrote later, "About 45 minutes into the shootout, the volume of gunfire finally started to slacken. We were running out of ammunition. The Davidians, however, had plenty. After the ceasefire, the Branch Davidians allowed the ATF dead and wounded to be evacuated and held their fire during the ATF retreat. Four ATF agents, Steve Willis, Robert Williams, not to be confused with Robin Williams, Todd McKeon, and Conway Charles LeBlue, were killed during the raid. However, another 16 were wounded. The five Branch Davidians killed in the 9:45 a.m. were Winston Blake, Peter Gent, Peter Hipsman, Perry Jones, and Jadeen Wendell, the hands of the Branch Davidians. Nearly 6 hours after the 11:30 a.m. ceasefire, Michael Schroeder was shot dead by ATF agents who alleged he fired a pistol at agents as he attempted to re-enter the compound with Woodrow Kendrick and Norman Allison. The local sheriff and audio tapes broadcast after the incident said that he was not apprised of the raid. Alan A. Stone's report states that the Branch Davidians did not ambush the ATF and that they apparently did not maximize the kill of ATF agents, explaining that they were rather desperate religious fanatics expecting an apocalyptic ending in which they were destined to die defending their sacred ground and destined to achieve salvation. A 1999 federal report noted the violent tendencies of dangerous cults can be classified into two general categories, defensive violence and offensive violence. Defensive violence is utilized by cults to defend a compound or enclave that was created specifically to eliminate most contact with that of the dominant culture. The 1993 clash in Waco, Texas, at the Branch Davidian complex is an illustration of such defensive violence. History has shown that groups that seek to withdraw from the dominant culture seldom act on their beliefs that the end time has come unless provoked. ATF agents established contact with Koresh and others inside the compound after they left from the initial shootout. The FBI took command soon after as the result of the deaths of federal agents, placing Jeff Jamar, head of the Bureau's San Antonio field office, in charge of the siege as site commander. The FBI hostage rescue team was headed by HRT Commander Richard Rogers, who had previously been criticized for his actions during the Ruby Ridge incident. And if you're not familiar with that, the Ruby Ridge incident was the site of an 11-day siege near Naples, Idaho, when Randy Weaver and members of his immediate family and family friend Kevin Harris resisted agents of the U.S. Marshals Service and the hostage rescue team, as well as the Federal Bureau of Investigation's hostage rescue team, from taking them place in which they were hiding. Ultimately, all casualties occurred on the first 2 days of the operation. The siege and standoff were ultimately resolved by civilian negotiators with the surrender and arrest of Kevin Harris on August 30th and the surrender of Randy Weaver and the surviving Weaver children the next day. Ultimately, there was an attempt by the U.S. Marshal Services to serve a warrant for Randy Weaver after his failure to appear on firearms charges. Ultimately, it resulted in the deaths of a number of people, among them being children. So let's just say Richard Rogers didn't have a sterling track record when he arrived on scene to handle this nonsense. So as at Ruby Ridge, Rogers often overrode the site commander at Waco and had mobilized both the blue and gold HRT tactical teams to the same site, which ultimately created pressure to resolve the situation tactically due to lack of HRT reserves. The Davidians had telephone contacts with local news media, and Koresh gave phone interviews. The FBI would cut Davidian communication to the outside world after this. For the next 51 days, communication with those inside was by telephone by a group of 50, or I should say 25 FBI negotiators. Sorry, guys, 25. The final Justice Department report found that negotiators criticized the tactical commanders for undercutting negotiations. So there's definitely a lot of tension between the negotiators and the site commanders, as well as the guys who are in charge of deploying the federal agents to take the building, should it be necessary. In the first few days, the FBI believed that they had made a breakthrough when they negotiated with Koresh an agreement that the Branch Davidians would peacefully leave the compound in return for a message recorded by Koresh being broadcast on national radio. The broadcast was made, but Koresh then told negotiators that God had told him to remain in the building and wait. Despite this, soon afterwards, negotiators managed to facilitate the release of 19 children ranging in age from 5 months to 12 years old without their parents. However, 98 people remained in the building at this time. The children were then interviewed by the FBI and Texas Rangers for some hours at a time. Allegedly, the children had been physically and sexually abused long before the standoff. This was the key justification offered by the FBI, both to the president at that time, Bill Clinton, and to Attorney General Janet Reno for launching tear gas attacks to force the Branch Davidians out of the compound. Now, during the siege, the FBI sent a video camera to the Branch Davidians. In the videotape made by Koresh's followers, Koresh introduced his children and his wives to the FBI negotiators, including several minors who claimed to have had babies followed by Koresh. Koresh had fathered perhaps 14 of the children who stayed with him in the compound. Several Branch Davidians made statements in the videos. In the video, on day 9, Monday, March 8th, the Branch Davidians sent out the videotape to show the FBI that there were no hostages, but in fact, everyone staying inside was doing so under their own free will. This video also included a message from Koresh. The negotiator's log showed that when the tape was reviewed, there was concern that the tapes released to the media would gain sympathy for Koresh and the Branch Davidians. Videos also showed the 23 children still inside the compound, and child care professionals on the outside prepared to take care of those children as well as the previous 21 released. As the siege continued, Koresh negotiated more time, allegedly so that he could write religious documents, which he said he needed to complete before he surrendered. His conversations, dense with biblical imagery, alienated the federal negotiators who treated the situation as a hostage crisis. As the siege wore on, two factions developed within the FBI, one believing negotiation to be the answer, the other, force. Increasingly aggressive techniques were used to try and force the Branch Davidians out. For example, sleep deprivation of the inhabitants by means of all-night broadcasts of recordings of jet planes, pop music team, and the screams of rabbits being slaughtered. Outside the compound, 9 Bradley fighting vehicles carrying M651 CS tear gas grenades and ferret rounds, and 5 M728 combat engineer vehicles obtained for the U.S. Army began patrolling. The Army armored vehicles were used to destroy perimeter fencing and outbuildings, as well as crush cars belonging to the Branch Davidians. Armored vehicles repeatedly drove over the grave of Branch Davidian David Peter Gent, despite protests by the Branch Davidians and negotiators. Two of the three water storage tanks on the roof of the main building had been damaged during the initial ATF raid, and eventually the FBI would cut all power and water in the compound, forcing those inside to survive on rainwater and stockpiled military MRE rations. Criticism would later be leveled by Snyder's attorney, Jack Zimmerman, at the tactic of using sleep and peace disrupting sound against the Branch Davidians. The point was this. They were trying to have sleep disturbance, and they were trying to take someone that they viewed as unstable to start with, and they were trying to drive him crazy. And then they got mad because he does something that they think is irrational. Despite the increasingly aggressive tactics, Koresh ordered a group of followers to leave. 11 people left and were arrested as material witnesses, with one person charged with conspiracy to murder. The children's willingness to stay with Koresh disturbed the negotiators, who were unprepared to work around the Branch Davidians' religious zeal. However, as the siege went on, the children were aware that an earlier group of children who had left with some women were immediately separated and the women arrested. During the siege, a number of scholars who study apocalypticism in religious groups attempted to persuade the FBI that the siege tactics being used by government agents would only reinforce the impression within the Branch Davidians that they were part of a biblical end times confrontation that had cosmic significance. This would likely increase the chances of a violent and deadly outcome. And thus, the religious scholars pointed out that the beliefs of the group may have appeared to be extreme, but the Branch Davidians But to the Branch Davidians, their religious beliefs were deeply meaningful and that they were willing to die for them. Koresh's discussions with the negotiating team became increasingly difficult. He proclaimed that he was the second coming of Christ and had been commanded by his Father in heaven to remain in the compound. 1 week prior to the April 19th assault, FBI planners considered using snipers to kill David Koresh and possibly other key Branch Davidians. The FBI voiced concern that the Branch Davidians might commit mass suicide, as it happened in 1978 at Jim Jones's Jonestown complex. Koresh had repeatedly denied any plans for mass suicide when confronted by negotiators during the standoff, and people leaving the compound had not seen any such preparation. Now, before we get to the final confrontation between David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, and the ATF and other federal forces in this tremendous saga, we're going to take another quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to wrap this all up, and we're going to ask some big questions. And we're going to see if we can find the answers together.
I'm black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back again, guys. And I know today's run a little bit long, but we've got a lot to cover, right? We've got a lot of things to cover. So now we've reached the final chapter in our saga, the final confrontation. Appointed U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno approved recommendations by the FBI hostage rescue team to mount an assault after being told that conditions were deteriorating and that children were being abused inside the compound. Thinking back to the April 19th, 1985 issues with the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord siege in Arkansas, which was ended without loss of life by a blockade and without a deadline, President Clinton suggested similar tactics against the Branch Davidians. Reno countered that the FBI hostage rescue team was tired of waiting, that the standoff was costing $1 million a week per week, and that the Branch Davidians could hold out longer than CSAL, and that the chances of child sexual abuse and mass suicide were imminent. The president later recounted, "Finally, I told her that if she thought it was the right thing to do, she could go ahead." Over the next several months, Janet Reno's reasons for approving the final gas attack varied from her initial claim that the FBI hostage rescue team had told her that Koresh was sexually abusing children and beating babies, to her claim that Linda Thompson and her one-woman unorganized militia of the United States was on the way to Waco to aid or attack Koresh. Because the Branch Davidians were heavily armed, the FBI rescue team arms included 50 caliber rifles and armored combat engineering vehicles. The assault took place on 1893. The CEVs used explosives to puncture holes in the walls of the building of the compound so they could pump CS tear gas in and try to flush out the Branch Davidians without harming them. You know, nothing like blowing up the walls to not harm them and then pumping in harmful gases to not harm them. The stated plan called for increasing amounts of gas to be pumped in over 2 days to increase pressure. Officially, no armed assault was to be made, and loudspeakers were to be used to tell the Branch Davidians that there would be no armed assault and to ask them not to fire on the vehicles. FBI hostage agents had been permitted to return any incoming fire, but no shots were fired by federal agents on April 19th. When several Branch Davidians opened fire, the rescue team's response was to increase the amount of gas being used. The FBI rescue team delivered 40-millimeter CS grenade fire from the M79 grenade launchers very early in the morning. The rescue team fired two M651 rounds, military rounds, at the Branch Davidian construction site, and around mid-morning, the FBI hostage rescue team began to run low on 40-millimeter Texas Ranger Captain David Burns for tear gas rounds. The tear gas rounds procured from Company F in Waco turned out to be unusable pyrotechnic rounds and were returned to the Company F office afterwards. 40-millimeter munitions recovered by the Texas Rangers at Waco included dozens of plastic Ferret M model SGA 400 liquid tear gas rounds, two metal M651E1 military pyrotechnic tear gas rounds, and two metal Nyko pyrotechnic sound and blast grenades, and a parachute, as well as parachute illumination flares. After more than 6 hours, no Branch Davidians had left the building, sheltering instead in a concrete block room within the building or using gas masks. The rescue team stated that the CEVs were used to punch large holes in the building to provide exits for those inside. At around noon, three fires broke out simultaneously in different parts of the building and quickly spread. The government maintains that the fires were deliberately started by the Branch Davidians, and some Branch Davidian survivors maintain, however, that the fires were accidentally or deliberately started by the assault. Only 9 people left the building during the fire. The remaining Davidians, including the children, were either burned alive by rubble, suffocated by the effects of the fire, or shot. Many who suffocated from the fire were killed by smoke or carbon monoxide inhalation and other causes as fire engulfed the building. Now, according to the FBI, Steve Snyder, Koresh's top aide, shot and killed Koresh and then killed himself with the same gun. Footage of the blaze that engulfed the building was broadcast by live television crews. In all, 76 Branch Davidians died, and 9 survived the fire on April 19th. 5 others had been killed in the initial ATF raid, and their bodies were buried on the grounds. 1 had been killed by the ATF after the raid, and 35 had left during the FBI siege. A large concentration of bodies, weapons, and munitions were found in the bunker. The Texas Rangers Arson Investigator Report assumes that many of the occupants either denied escape from within or refused to leave until escape was not an option. It also mentions that the structural debris from the breaching operations on the west end of the building could have blocked a possible escape route through the tunnel system. An independent investigation by 2 experts from the University of Maryland's Department of Fire Protection Engineering concluded that the compound residents had sufficient time to escape the fire if they had so desired. Autopsies of the dead revealed that some women and children found beneath a fallen concrete wall of a storage room died of skull injuries. Autopsy photographs of other children locked in what appeared to be spasmic death poses are consistent with cyanide poison, one of the results produced by burning tear gas. The U.S. Department of Justice report indicated that only one body had traces of benzene, one of the components of solvent dispersed CS gas, but that the gas insertions had finished nearly 1 hour before the fire started and that it was enough time for solvents to dissipate from the bodies of the Branch Davidians that had inhaled the tear gas. Autopsy records also indicate that at least 20 Branch Davidians were shot, including children under the age of 14, 5 of them. 3-year-old Daylon Gent was stabbed in the chest. The medical examiner who performed the autopsies believed that these deaths were mercy killings by the Branch Davidians trapped in the fire with no escape. The expert retained by the U.S. Office of Special Counsel concluded that many of the gunshot wounds support self-destruction either by overt suicide, consensual execution, suicide by proxy, or less likely force execution. Aftermath of this tremendous scandal, the new ATF director, John Magaw, criticized several aspects of the ATF raid. He made the Treasury Blue Book report on Waco required reading for new agents, and a 1995 Government Accountability Office report on use of force by federal law enforcement agencies observed that on the basis of Treasury's report on the Waco operation and the views of tactical operations experts and ATF's own personnel, ATF decided in October 1995 that dynamic entry would only be planned after all other options had been considered and began to adjust its training accordingly. Nothing remains of the buildings today other than the concrete foundation components, as the entire site was bulldozed 2 weeks after the end of the siege. A small chapel built years after the siege stands on its site. The events of Waco spurred both criminal prosecution and civil litigation. On August 3, 1993, a federal grand jury returned a superseding 10-count indictment against 12 of the surviving Branch Davidians. The grand jury charged, among other things, that the Branch Davidians had conspired to and aided and abetted in the murder of federal officers and had unlawfully possessed and used various firearms. The government dismissed the charges against one of the 12 Branch Davidians pursuant to a plea bargain. After a jury trial lasting nearly 2 months, the jury acquitted four of the Branch Davidians on all charges. Additionally, the jury acquitted all the Branch Davidians on the murder-related charges, but convicted five of them on lesser charges, including aiding and abetting the voluntary manslaughter of federal agents. Eight Branch Davidians were convicted on firearms charges. So these are the convicted Branch Davidians who received sentences of up to 40 years. Kevin A. Whitecliff, convicted of manslaughter. Jamie Castillo, manslaughter. Paul Gordon Fada, convicted of conspiracy to possess machine guns and aiding Branch Davidian leader Koresh in possessing machine guns. Renos Lenny Abram, convicted of manslaughter. Graham Leonard Craddock, convicted of possessing a grenade and using it possessing a firearm during a crime. Brad Eugene Branch, convicted of manslaughter. Livingstone Fagan, convicted of manslaughter. Ruth Riddle, convicted of using or carrying a weapon during a crime. And Catherine Schroeder, sentenced to 3 years after pleading guilty to a reduced charge of forcibly resisting arrest. Important to note that a number of these people are foreign nationals. Abram, Craddock, Hagen and Riddle all are foreign nationals, two from Britain, one Australia, one from Canada. Six of the eight Branch Davidians appealed their sentences and their convictions. They raised a host of issues challenging the constitutionality of the prohibition on possession of machine guns, the jury instructions, the district court's conduct of the trial, the sufficiency of the evidence, and the sentences imposed. The U.S. State Court of Appeal vacated the defendant's sentences for use of machine guns, determining that the district court had made no finding that they had actively employed the weapons, but left the verdicts undisturbed in all other respects. On remand, the district court found that the defendants had actively employed machine guns and resentenced five of them to substantial prison terms. The defendants again appealed, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed. The Branch Davidians pressed this issue before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed, holding the term machine gun in the relevant statute created an element of the offense to be determined by a jury rather than a sentencing factor to be determined by a judge, as it happened in the trial court. On September 19, 2000, Judge Walter Smith followed the Supreme Court's instructions and cut 25 years from the sentences of five convicted Branch Davidians and 5 years from the sentence of another. All Branch Davidians had been released from prison as of July of 2007. Several of the surviving Branch Davidians, as well as more than 100 family members of those who had died or were injured during this confrontation, brought civil suits against the United States government, numerous federal officials, the former governor of Texas, Ann Richards, and members of the Texas Army National Guard. They sought monetary damages under the Federal Tort Claims Act, civil rights statutes, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, and Texas state law. The bulk of these claims were dismissed because they were insufficient as a matter of law or because the plaintiffs could advance no material evidence in support of them. The court, however, after a month-long trial, rejected the Branch Davidians' case and found that on February 28, 1993, the Branch Davidians had initiated a gun battle when they fired at federal officers who were attempting to serve lawful warrants to the building. The court ruled in order to protect themselves and other agents from death or serious bodily harm. The court found that the government's planning of the siege, the decisions to use tear gas against the Branch Davidians, to insert the tear gas by means of military vehicles, and to omit specific planning for the possibility that a fire would erupt, was a discretionary function for which government could not be sued. The court also found that the use of tear gas was not negligent. Further, even if the United States government were negligent by causing damage to the buildings before the fires broke out, thus either blocking escape routes or enabling the fire to spread faster, that negligence did not legally cause the plaintiff's injuries because the Branch Davidians started the fires, according to the courts. The Branch Davidians appealed, and their contention was that the trial court judge, Walter S. Smith Jr., should have recused himself from the hearing hearing their claims on account of his relationships with defendants, defense counsel, and court staff prior judicial determinations and comments during trial. The Fifth Circuit concluded that these allegations did not reflect conduct that would cause a reasonable observer to question the judge's impartiality, and affirmed that the take-nothing judgment would stand. Interestingly enough, 33 British citizens were among the members of the Branch Davidians during the siege, and 24 of them were among the 80 fatalities, the nearly 80 of them, in the raid of February 28th and the assault of April 19th, including at least one child. Two more British nationals who survived the siege were immediately arrested as material witnesses and imprisoned without trial for months. Derek Lovelock was held in McLennan County Jail for 7 months, often in solitary confinement, and Livingstone Fagan, another British citizen who was among those convicted in prison, says he received multiple beatings at the hands of correctional officers, particularly at Leavenworth. There, he claims to have been doused inside his cell with cold water from a high-pressure hose, after which the industrial fan was placed outside the cell, blasting him with cold air. He was repeatedly moved between at least 9 different facilities and strip searched every time he took exercise, so he refused exercise. He would later be released and deported back to the UK in the year 2007, but still held on to his religious beliefs. Ultimately, there's no nice way to say this. This entire event was a massive clusterfuck on the part of the ATF and the Branch Davidians. On the one hand, whether or not the Branch Davidians had acquired illicit firearms is still something we do not know for certain, as much of the armaments that they have were destroyed in the fire. Now, to this day, we still are not certain who started these fires, how they occurred. But what we do know is that nearly 100 people from both, if we combine the fatalities from both parties here, died because both sides were unwilling to find a common middle ground, and both sides had no idea how to interact with the other. Ultimately, the ATF deserves a lot of criticism for the way that they handled this situation, simply for the fact that they couldn't get on the same page with their own agents. They had agents saying, let's negotiate, and agents saying, nah, forget that, let's just kill them all. And they couldn't find any common ground. Even when the Branch Davidians were willing to negotiate, there was too much disunity within parties involved in this investigation, whether it be members of the FBI, members of the ATF, Texas Rangers, members of the Texas branch of the National Guard. There was too many hats in this circle. There were too many people with cards on this table. And ultimately, they were all trying to run the show. And this led to massive amounts of miscommunication, massive amounts of foolish endeavors on the part of federal officers and local law enforcement. I mean, they had absolutely no control of this situation from its outset. Whether or not the Branch Davidians fired at them upon their arrival or not, it's still a matter of debate between scholars who have covered this situation. But what we do know is that gunfire was exchanged between the Branch Davidians and federal agents, and it resulted in the deaths of federal agents and members of the Branch Davidians, and culminated into a 51-day-long siege that ultimately led to the destruction of Mount Carmel and the deaths of everyone still in the compound. So what's the ultimate takeaway from this event? The ultimate takeaway I think we can have from this event is that we need to reevaluate how we look at those we perceive to be extreme groups. We need to reevaluate how we deal with people who we don't agree with, and we need to reevaluate how we deal with what we would consider to be society's outcasts or dregs. And those people who purposely isolate themselves from the rest of society sometimes need to just be left alone. Up until the point that we have this violent confrontation between the ATF and the Branch Davidians, there had only been two incidents. And those two incidents had occurred well before this event happened, nearly a decade before this event happened. So we have nearly a decade in which the Branch Davidians are minding their own business, not really causing any trouble. Now, other half of the story is that the accusations that David Koresh was engaged in illicit relationships with underage women and that there was child abuse taking place in this compound. Now, judging by what we know of David Koresh's background, the fact that he grew up in a very unhealthy environment with an alcoholic and abusive figure in his life and being shifted around from family member to family member, having a very loose relationship with his mother, and not really having very strong emotional ties, dropping out of school at an early age because of the fact that he couldn't really identify with kids his own age and he suffered from learning disabilities, we might be able to assume that combining these things with his religious fanaticism, perhaps it's entirely possible and probable that maybe David Koresh was doing these things. But we don't know this for sure because the only thing we have is the testimonies of a few people who didn't like David Koresh and left the group. That's not to say that David Koresh did not engage in these illicit behaviors, but it is to say that the evidence, even before federal officials, inconclusive evidence. So we're still not certain. We do have David Koresh's own words that he had many daughters with many different women who he declared to be his wives. And by the letter of law in Texas, there were laws against polygamy. So in that way, he was breaking the law. But whether or not they were with young girls, we still don't know for certain. Despite that fact, David Koresh and the Branch Davidians died tragically in their compound. Whether we agree or not with the beliefs of David Koresh and the Branch Davidians is not entirely relevant. What is important is that they died as a result of poor execution and poor management of federal funds by federal officials. One might say that their fanaticism and their firm belief that they were on the cutting edge, that they themselves were going to be part of a great battle, final apocalyptic battle between the forces of good and evil, and that they were so obsessed with the end of the world that they were willing to go the distance, to sacrifice themselves for what they believed in, that contributed to their downfall, and certainly did. But we must not forget that it's not just the extremism of the Branch Davidians and David Koresh that leads to their downfall. It's the foolishness and ineptitude of officials who were left in charge of negotiating with them that lead to not only their deaths, but the deaths of the agents who failed. That's all I've got for you guys today on this incident. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. We're going to be bringing back mythical segments in the coming weeks. We're going to be veering away from cold history for a while and getting into some more mythology and more legends and urban tales. For those of you interested in taking a look at some more on this incident, I want to make a few recommendations to you guys. First, I would like to recommend that you take a look at Armageddon and Waco, Critical Perspectives on the Branch Davidian Conflict, published by Stuart A. Wright. You'll also want to take a look at Revis J. Dix, The Ashes of Waco, An Investigation. And there are numerous articles on this. You may also take a look at Kenneth Newport's The Branch Davidians of Waco, The History and Beliefs. That's all I've got for you guys today. I hope you enjoyed this show. I hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about this very controversial event in American history. And I look forward to having you all back with me next week. Until then, enjoy the rest of your week and enjoy the upcoming holidays, guys. I'll see you soon.